Ladies and gentlemen, a good morning. It's wonderful to start a Sunday morning speaking about shots and vaccinations. But Rabbi Ellis requested that I begin a series that I believe he wants to start in the community on medical ethics. And we decided together that because of the events of this past year, we would address the topic of triage in vaccination allocation. I don't think I have to tell anyone around this table how we were scared stiff this year when H1N1 came on the scene. And because we were scared stiff, we wanted to get vaccinated. And as you all know, getting vaccinated for H1N1 was a real topic in Canada. If you look on your source sheets, on the first source, you could see that I downloaded from CanWest News Service that the Vancouver Sun, as you could see here, this particular year in Canada, H1N1 took its toll on the productivity of workers. There were many people that were out of work this year because of H1N1. It was a flu that didn't go away in a day. And ultimately, because of that, the productivity of Canadian workers, and therefore ramifications on the economy and whatnot, were very, very fierce because of H1N1. You can see the article in front of you, and you could see the part that I bolded. You could see that ultimately 418 deaths have been linked to this particular virus. And ultimately, if you look on the top of this article, you could see that 1.5 million people lost 19.6 hours of work each because either they were sick or an immediate family member was ill with H1N1. H1N1 was a very bad flu, and ultimately the economy suffered this year, not to mention the fact that ultimately many, many people died. According to this particular article from January 15th of this year, 418 people died because of this virus. If you turn the page, you'll see that because H1N1 was such a fierce virus, we had to get vaccinations here in Canada. And because we had to get vaccinations, there was a very big problem. The problem was there wasn't enough vaccinations to go around. And that's the way it usually is with medical resources. There's usually not enough to go around. If you look on page 2, you'll see that I downloaded from the Public Health Agency of Canada's website the sequencing, I love that word, sequencing of who gets the H1N1 first, second, third. That is known in fancy language as what? Triage, correct. Namely, we don't have enough resources to go around. Who gets first? Who gets second? When you go on an airplane and they say, if God forbid, the pressure in the cabin will go down, put on your mask first and then help the person next to you. Again, has to do with triage and other concerns as well. But if you look in this page, you could see that the Public Health Agency of Canada delineated the various people that would get the vaccination. It starts out with chronic conditions, then pregnant women, children with 6 months to less than 5 years of age, and onwards and onwards. At the bottom of the page, you could see how it says others who will benefit from immunization. Namely, not as critical at the top of the list, but will benefit. In the modern commonplace in which we all live, there is not enough to go around in terms of medical resources. And when H1N1 hit Canada, 418 people died, so many people were out of work, the Canadian officials had to decide who gets it first, who gets it second. And it was very, very legitimate to put out a list like this because there wasn't enough to go around. This morning's lecture will try to address this list in terms of the Jewish sources and the halachic deciders of our generation. When you have limited resources, who goes first? Is the question clear? Great. Just to try to illustrate how much this hit Canada, allow me to refresh your memories. I'm sure everyone around this table knows about what I'm about to say much better than me. I heard about it secondhand and third hand in Israel, but if you turn the page, you will see the famous Calgary Flames episode of this year. I think that from time immemorial, we're going to talk about the Calgary Flames and how they stirred up many flames in Canada. Does everyone here know the story? Great. Does anyone here not know the story? Okay, who would like to repeat the story? In a minute.
Just a few.
Huh?
Just a few.
All right, explain, Mr. Ben-Arush.
Well, they were on visa, so they were able to get around to you, and all of them get H1N1. They weren't considered a higher institution.
Correct. I think you're absolutely right. So, according to what you just said, this is what happened. Calgary is in which province?
Alberta.
The Alberta officials decided, in their wisdom, that we are not going to decide triage in vaccination allocation. Line up, first come, first serve. A very interesting point of view. And people lined up out the door to get vaccinated in Alberta. The Calgary Flames didn't like that. Yes, we're living in a country with socialized medicine. And yes, nobody can jump the queue, but the Calgary Flames found the way. I downloaded from the CBC website, as you can see on page 3, the whole series of events. The Calgary Flames decided to set up their own private clinic. All of the team members and their families were vaccinated. Long before the triage list we saw on page 2, they did not have to line up in the long lines in Alberta that we saw on the news. And if you don't believe me, all this is downloaded from a very good website of a very good television station called CBC. As far as I know, they usually say authentic news outside of their reports from Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, this was an outrage. Calgary Flames get vaccinated before everyone. They're not a high-risk group, as Mrs. Ben-Arush just said. They set up their own private clinic in a country with socialized medicine. There was nothing that was more immoral, unethical, and disgusting than that. And as you can see here, I tried to bring the series of events. Ultimately, if you look at number 4, many people were fired because of this. And ultimately, this was a terrible event in a country in which people wanted to get vaccinated, were anxious to get vaccinated against a flu, which turned out to be a very fatal flu for 418 people in Canada, and many more were sick. Now, the bottom line is that we got through H1N1 this year. If you look on number 4 on this particular page, you'll see that, thank God, there is too many vaccinations left over as of the month of February 2010. I'll just read from the website of CBC. As of January 11th, 7,000 extra doses of H1N1 influenza vaccine remains in the Northwest Territories. So, ladies and gentlemen, we got through H1N1. There's plenty of vaccinations left. However, this lecture is coming on the backdrop of what we've experienced this year, but ultimately what we may, God forbid, experience in the future. Who says that this won't happen again? If H1N1 came about, who knows if it's going to be an H1N2 and an H1N3 and whatnot. And therefore, if you turn the page, we're going to start this morning to try to see what Judaism says about vaccination allocation and triage when it comes to limited medical resources. So to sum up what I said until now in 6 minutes, I will say in half a minute, there's not enough medical resources to go around. Fatal flus like H1N1 might, God forbid, come again. Who gets it first? Who gets it second, according to Jewish law? Everyone has a source sheet? Everyone, let us begin. We are now on page, these pages, oh God, I didn't put numbers. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Page 4 of the handout. Yeah.
Oh my they were told, the letter we received from the yeshiva, that they received from the Israeli, so that the information from the Israeli.
I am flabbergasted to hear that. I really am.
Just kind of the opposite of...
Of the opposite of what we're reading over here. I am flabbergasted. What can I say? I am amazed by that, and it's awful to hear that. Really awful to hear that about a Jewish country. Not everything in Israel is run by Jewish law, unfortunately, but ultimately to do such a thing is awful.
Terrible.
Awful. Anyway, I didn't know that, and with your permission, I'll see what I could do to find out more information about it. We got through H1N1, but I don't want that to happen again. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, let me give you three words of introduction with regard to Jewish law in general before we get into the question of triage. Number one, there is an absolute obligation in Jewish law to save lives. Saving lives is so important that it overrides everything outside of three cardinal sins. So case scenario on Shabbat, you're in shul, someone, God forbid, gets a heart attack, you do everything to save that life, violating all the 39 biblical laws of Shabbos and all the rest of the rabbinic laws in order to save that life. In a word, life is more important than religion. We live to live a religious life. We don't die for our religion outside of three cardinal sins. Not only is that true, but if you look in the top of the source sheet, you will see that according to the verse in Vayikra, you shall not stand idle by the shedding of your fellow's blood, which means not only do we do everything to save a life, we have an obligation to save a life. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, page 73a, how do we know that if I see my friend drowning in a river, or a wild beast dragging him away, or bandits coming after him, that I must save him? We know it, for it's written, you shall not stand idle by the shedding of your fellow's blood. So not only do we go out of our way to save a life, we are obligated to save a life. And the Rambam, the rabbi, Dr. Maimonides, codifies it in his Code of Jewish Law, and I'll just read it. If an avalanche of stones fell on someone, and it's doubtful if he's under there, we're talking about Shabbos, where stones are muktzeh, and you can't pick up the stones on Shabbos, we still move away the stones. If we find him alive, even though he is shattered and can't be fully healed, we still move away the stones and get him out of there, even if he will live just for another short time. So we go out of our way to save a life, and we have an obligation to do so. Introduction number two. We also have an obligation not just to save a life, but to heal. What does it mean to heal? A person comes in, he's not dangerously ill, like the person under the avalanche of stones, but he comes in to Dr. Gal's clinic, and he's sick. A virus, he has strep. The doctor, for sure, has an obligation to heal that person. If you look in the verses we read just a few weeks ago in Parshat Mishpatim, it says, if men quarrel and ultimately one gives the other a bop in the face and the person gets, I don't know, something happens to him, ultimately it says at the end of that that he has to pay compensation to that person because striking someone's against Jewish law and hurting someone's against Jewish law, and that person duly gets compensation for the embarrassment, for the physical hurt, and ultimately, according to those verses, at the end of it, if you look, and he shall provide for his cure. Or in Hebrew, verapo yirape. Now, because in Hebrew there's two words, rapo yirape, and as we mentioned yesterday, the Torah doesn't waste words, the Gemara, in Tractate Bava Kamma 85a, tries to understand why is it written twice. So the Gemara says that it's written twice for the following reason. From here we deduce that a doctor has permission to heal. Not only do you have to provide for the person's healing, namely for his medicine, the extra rapo yirape, the extra word there, teaches us that we have permission to heal someone. The Ramban in the next source explains that you would have thought that, hey, why should I get messed up with this? A person comes into my office, he's sick. If I give him medicine, he may be cured. But sometimes, if I give him medicine, what might happen? He might go the other way. He needs a blood transfusion. It might help him, but if I give him the wrong kind of blood, he, God forbid, may die. So Dr. Gal might say, why do I need this headache? Why should I, God forbid, be sued for malpractice? Enough! I don't need it! The Ramban therefore explains in a book or in an essay called Torat HaAdam, the Ramban is Nachmanides, by the way, a little later than the Rambam, Rabbi Dr. Maimonides. The Ramban says that ultimately this Gemara teaches us that even though you may have said, listen, saving lives is so important, so therefore why get messed up and, God forbid, maybe hurting someone through medical care, this teaches us you have a right to do it, you have permission to heal, and even if it goes the wrong way, you're scot-free according to Jewish law. God is saying, I am allowing you to take the chance to try to heal the person. God is saying to the Jewish people, I am giving you the right to take a chance. And that's the way doctors work. This is the permission for the medical world to come about. So how does Dr. Gal run a clinic? Look, his treatment may work, may not. God says, even if it doesn't work, I'm not going to blame you, because you're going to do your best. You have permission to heal. Yes?
Excuse me. Does this apply to euthanasia also?
To what?
Euthanasia.
Euthanasia. I'm sorry. No.
Is there another law?
There is. That's a separate lecture in and of itself. There is. Absolutely. So, just to sum up, yes. We have a lot to do next time I come. Rabbi, can I get a napkin, please? So first and foremost, we see that we have an obligation to save lives. Secondly, doctors have a right to try to heal people, even if there's a chance that they won't heal them. They might even make them worse, as sometimes happens. They can tell them, take steroids, and instead of healing the asthma, it might make the asthma worse. According to this Gemara, based on the verses, they have a right to take that chance. In general, in Judaism, we don't take bad chances, only good chances. Doctors have a right to take the chance, a right to heal. Number three. Number three is that according to Jewish law, no life is more important than the other life. If you look in the Gemara and Tractate Pesachim 25b on the bottom of the page, you will see that a person came to Rabbah and said, kill him or I kill you. A guy came to Rabbah, put a gun to his head and said, Rabbah, I want you to take this gun and I want you to kill Rabbi Ellis. And if you don't kill Rabbi Ellis, I'm going to kill you. What do you do?
Die.
You die. Says the Gemara, you can kill me, but I won't kill him. What do you think? That my blood is more red than him? Perhaps his blood is more red than mine. That should be red, not read. Every one of my sheets this week has a spelling mistake. All right. Gentlemen and ladies, according to this Gemara, and the Rambam codifies this in his Code of Jewish Law, killing another to save someone, it's logical that we don't kill one person to save another. No life is more important than the other life. So based on these three sources, the obligation to save a life under all circumstances, the right to heal, and the fact that no life is more important than the other, it would be very hard to start a conversation on triage. Because by definition, if your life is no more important than my life, why should I get vaccinated and you don't? And if the red doctor has an obligation to heal everyone, then anyone that comes in should be healed right away. There should be no triage. And if we have an obligation to save lives, then we have to save all lives. So according to these three bits of information, A, the obligation to save a life, B, the right to heal, and C, no life is more important than the other, it would be very difficult for us right now to begin a conversation on triage, because no life is more important than the other. But I'm going to try anyway. If you turn the page, I quoted to you from the Wall Street Journal from October 6, 2006, which basically presents the question that we're about to deal with in a very vivid way. Would anyone like to read it?
You have 100 doses of... Oh, can I?
Yeah, go right ahead.
You have 100 doses of a vaccine against the deadly strain of influenza that is sweeping the country. With no prospect of obtaining more. Standing in line are 100 school children and 100 elderly people. The elderly are more likely to die if they catch the flu. But they also have fewer years left to live and don't get out enough to easily spread or catch the disease. The kids are more likely to act like little typhoid Mary. Sneezing virus over everyone they encounter and have almost their whole life ahead of them. That means again, the kids are more likely to act like little typhoid Mary, sneezing virus over everyone they encounter and have almost their whole life ahead of them. But they're also less likely to die than their kids. Who do you vaccinate?
I don't know a better way to present the question. 100 kids are in front of you. Who do you give vaccination to? You don't have enough for everyone. We just said that no life is more important than the other, according to Jewish law. And if that's the case, it's going to be very difficult to have this conversation, but we're living in the real world, and halacha must deal with the real world, because if halacha can't deal with the real world, it's no longer applicable in this day and age. So let's see what the halacha says with regard to triage in such a situation where you have limited medical resources. The Gemara in Bava Metzia, page Samech Bet, Nun Samech, 62a. Two people are traveling on a journey in the desert, and one has a pitcher of water. If they both drink from the pitcher, they won't get to civilization, and they'll die. If one person drinks the whole pitcher of water, he will make it to civilization, but his friend traveling with him, who will get no water, will die. What do you do? Comes along Ben Patura and says they should both drink equally, and if they die, they die, because no life is more important than the other. Rabbi Akiva, on the other hand, comes and says, no. The Pasuk says your brother may live with you, meaning you should do everything to save lives if they can live together. From here we learn, your life takes precedence over his life. So in a case in which you have the vaccination in your hand, you have it, and you can give part of it to you and part of it to me, but none of us would be fully vaccinated. Ben Patura says that's what you do, and Rabbi Akiva says no. You have the vaccination, your life comes before your friend's life. You have an obligation to save your own life prior to trying to save other people's lives. And that opinion of Rabbi Akiva is codified, as you could see here, in all the Jewish sources, the Sardis of law. I quoted the Rif, the Rosh, onwards. Ultimately, Chayecha kodmin lechayecha verecha, your life takes precedence over someone else's life.
The airplane solution.
Very good. Like we do on the airplane, you put on your mask, and ultimately you help others. Your life takes precedence over other lives. One second. I'm just going to point out two practical ramifications of this. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was the big decider of Jewish law in the past generation, died in 1986 in the Lower East Side of New York. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in his book Igrot Moshe, which is a responsa, brings the case that you're in the hospital and you have one respirator and another person comes in, and this person is more dangerously ill than the person on the respirator. Says Rav Moshe Feinstein, if he's already on the respirator, it's in his hands, his life comes first. Another decider of Jewish law, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who died in Israel in 1994, in the next source, in the Minchat Shlomo, says exactly the same thing, and he says it even more nicer. He says, it's as if he bought the respirator. It's his. So in a case in which the resource is in your hand, your life comes first. But here, we're not talking about where the vaccination's in our hand. Who holds the vaccination?
Third party.
A third party. So this source is talking about if you already have the vaccination or the respirator. It doesn't talk about if a third party has it. But you had something to say. Pardon? As hard as it is for me to say it, because I'm a parent myself, according to this source, you have to vaccinate yourself before your child. As hard as it is for me to say that statement, and I'm a parent, and I just spoke to my kids before davening this morning, and I saw their cute faces. It is very hard for me to say, but according to this source, your life comes first.
But isn't there some element of the relative risk to the people for being vaccinated?
Absolutely. We'll get to that. But here again, relative risks, measurement of different danger levels are very important. As I forgot your name, Mr. President, I'm sorry. Your first name. Honorable Mr. President, your first name? Sherman said very nicely that we're not here talking about if you have the resource in your hand. We're talking about a third party having the resource, and the question and the considerations you brought up are very important then. Elements of risks and whatnot. But in this point, we're talking about if you had the resource in your hand. So, if you have the resource in your hand, your life comes first, and as hard as it is for me to say it, maybe even before your kids. Okay? Number two. If you turn the page, on the bottom of the page, you will see the Gemara in Horayot. Horayot, page 13b, please turn the page. You will see a very long Gemara. It is so long, ladies and gentlemen, that if we learn it, we will be here all day. This Gemara is vital and crucial for our discussion. We are not talking here about vaccination. We're talking about a person. We're talking about a lot of people who were taken captive. And you don't have enough money to redeem them from captivity. So what's the question? Who's first? And look at this Gemara. You will see that the Mishnah and the Gemara in Horayot 13a brings different triage situations. And they're very hard for us to utter today, but you can probably see the logic. For example, it says here that a free person goes before a slave. A Kohen goes before a Levi. Much harder for our modern or postmodern mind to understand. God forbid a man takes precedence over a woman in matters concerning saving a life. But if God forbid... Oh gosh... I knew how to keep you in. Anyway, the Gemara doesn't say that, the Mishnah doesn't say always, it says only in certain situations, and God forbid there was a captivity in which there was any sort of proposed danger of sexual immorality that might change, but ultimately this Gemara in Horayot brings different situations of triage. Kohen before a Levi, a free person before a slave and whatnot. If you'd like to read through it at home, it's fascinating. And it's difficult for our mind to hear, especially since we just learned that no life is more important than another. But ultimately, this is going to be an important Gemara for our discussion this morning. And if I can just quote and sum up this Gemara, if you look on the bottom of the page, Rabbi Dr. Fred Rosner, who's one of the, I would say, prolific writers on medical ethics in general. He edited books, he wrote many articles. In an article in which he wrote, Rationing the Medical Care, he says that from this Gemara we learn, Judaism considers religious status, personal dignity, and social worth as determining factors in the allocation of limited ransom money to redeem captives from their captors. So you have limited resources, different considerations come about, such as social worth, personal dignity, religious status. These are the things you have to think about. So what we've established according to this Gemara is that if a third party has the money to redeem captives, you do take into consideration triage concerns. Though there is an obligation to save lives and to heal and to ultimately no life is more important than the other, the Gemara does foresee a situation where you don't have enough to do it all. You can't heal everyone, and you can't save everyone. You can only save a select few. Personal dignity, religious status, and social worth are going to be some of the considerations we will consider. If you turn the page, you will now get into the actual question after all these wonderful words of introduction. So, just to see sum up until now, we have an obligation to save lives, we have a right to heal, and no life is more important than the other. The extreme situation in which you have the vaccine in your hands, your life comes first. But if a third party has the vaccine, as is usually the case, we could see that the Gemara in Horayot brings different triage situations, such as personal dignity and social status and whatnot. There are four viewpoints in Jewish law with regard to our question of triage vaccination. Let us begin to see them. The first viewpoint I wanted to point out is the Chazon Ish. Who was the Chazon Ish? I don't think, as Rabbi J.J. Schachter says many times, I don't think his mother said, Chazon Ish, Kimahel, Esabisalem. The Chazon Ish, anyone know who he was?
He's a male apple.
No. Nice guess, though. The Chazon Ish was born in Lithuania. He died in Israel in 1950-something, I believe 1953 or 1958, I forgot. He was originally from Lithuania, came to Israel, lived in Bnei Brak, one of the leaders of what we call the ultra-orthodox sect for all generations, especially the Lithuanian side of it. He was a prolific writer. He ultimately always learned alone, never learned in a real yeshiva. He was autodidactic, and he is quoted and requoted many, many times in the discussions of Jewish thought, Jewish law, Jewish learning. The Chazon Ish, however, because he never learned in a yeshiva and he basically ruled alone, we usually talk about him as the chumrah of the Chazon Ish, or the stringent opinion of the Chazon Ish, because he wasn't part of a court, he wasn't part of the mainstream. As we say in Yiddish, he was zitzen avinkel. He sat in a little corner and he learned. But an amazing mind, and on this question, which seems to be a contradiction in his words. On the one hand, he says in one place, on his glosses on the Rambam's Code of Jewish Law on the right side, he says that you give an equal amount to the entire population. You don't have enough vaccines for everyone. Equal, Stephen, to everyone. Because why? No life is more important than the other. On the other hand, he says on his glosses on Tractate Bava Metzia, where we just learned about the two people in the desert with the pitcher of water, he says there the following. It seems that if someone had water and two thirsty people are in front of him, meaning a third party has the water, this too would be dependent on the argument. According to Ben Ptura, you give equal amounts to each, and according to Rabbi Akiva, since he's the third party, who does he give it to of the two people? Anyone he wants. Anyone he wants! Because no life is more important than the other, right? You only have enough to save one, so it would be stupid to give an equal amount and not save anyone. So, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, catch a tiger by its toe, you! Okay? Because no life is more important than the other. So you have no choice. If you give an equal amount to both, no one's going to be healed. Everyone's going to get H1N1. If you give to one, he will be healed, the other won't. You can't pick. So what do? Flip a coin. That's the opinion of Rabbi Akiva according to the amazing mind of the Chazon Ish. So, according to the Chazon Ish, either you give an equal amount to both, and you're not going to heal either totally, but maybe a shtickle it. In H1N1, if you give a small dose, would it start the immune system, Dr. Gal? In other words, you may heal them a touch. Okay.
Here our vaccine is an adjuvant. Compared to the vaccine in the States, we used an adjuvant vaccine.
Okay.
It has a little, like maybe a third or a quarter of the actual vaccine and something to stimulate the immune system. So it, we have, that's why we have excess vaccine here. While in the States, they used the non-adjuvant vaccine. So they need four times as much to vaccinate people.
Interesting. That's interesting. Very interesting. So according to the Chazon Ish, according to one place, you give an equal amount to both, you cannot decide whose life is more important. According to another place in the Chazon Ish, you don't know which life is more important, but it's stupid to give to one and not to the other because you're not going to heal either. Maybe a little bit, as you say. So what does he say? Decide which one. I mean, there's no way of deciding. I cannot give you any sort of a list because every life is important. So flip a coin and whoever gets it, gets it. Fight for it. I don't know. But whatever it is, any life gets it. That's the opinion of the Chazon Ish. And now let's go on to the second opinion of the Igrot Moshe. Just to sum up again, either the Chazon Ish says equal Stephen to the whole population, or there's no way of knowing which life is more important. Pick one. Pick one. Like in Alberta. Line up, whoever comes gets the vaccine. Comes Rav Moshe Feinstein, again Rav Moshe Feinstein, living in first in Russia, moving to New York, died in New York 1986, one of the primary deciders of Jewish law of the past generation, especially the 20th century, quoted to the year 2010, requoted and requoted. Rav Moshe Feinstein does not talk about vaccinations, he's talking about an emergency room. Two people come in. One seems to be dangerously ill and needs immediate care, But that person will probably not live too much longer. You may be able to prolong his life for maybe 2-3 hours. Okay? The other person comes in, also dangerously ill, but not as ill right now as the first person, and you'd probably be able to totally heal him. And you don't have enough resources. Who goes first? Rav Moshe Feinstein begins by saying the person that's acutely dangerously ill, even if you're only going to prolong his life a little bit, goes first. But then he says in an emergency room it's very hard to determine if that's true. Now, Dr. Gal, are you a doctor as well? What's your first name?
Alan.
Alan and Dr. Gal. Now, you're in the emergency room sometimes. Dr. Alan and Dr. Gal, you can tell me if that's true. Meaning, when two people come into the emergency room, is it sometimes very hard to determine who's more dangerously ill than the other? Two guys are holding their chest, but is there a way right away to determine?
It would be hard.
It would be difficult. Yeah.
Sometimes,
no. So ultimately,
but they always try, which is why you have long lineups in the world.
That's right. They always do try. You try.
Grouping. Grouping more than this is more likely to be seriously. So if someone comes in with chest pain.
No, no, we're talking about Canada, socialized medicine. Not who you know. So Rav Moshe Feinstein comes along and says, listen, in a perfect situation, the doctors would be able to determine who is right now more dangerously ill. He would go first, because we always save a life even to prolong it a little bit. But it's very hard in an emergency room to decide that right away. So two people come in at the same time, who do you treat first? It's very hard at that moment to make that determination because you don't know for sure who's more dangerously ill, who's less. Says Rav Moshe Feinstein, because of that situation, adding into it maybe what happens in America more than Canada, that you sometimes don't tell the patient how terrible their situation is, because that might kill them in and of itself, mentally. And mentally it would have ramifications on their physical well-being. Now, there's two doctors here, you can tell me if the statement I just made was correct. I'm very happy that that changed. When I was growing up in America, I remember that when people were dangerously ill, they never told them their whole situation, and I personally don't think that's correct. I don't think that's correct. You can't withhold information.
I think you tell people.
So tell us, Rav Moshe Feinstein, there's no way, A, to determine who's more dangerously ill and who's not. So who do you admit first to the emergency room is very difficult. B, in the situation in which he wrote this, this was written in 1971, you don't tell the patient how bad they are, so by definition, you don't know how bad they are. They come and they say, I have a situation, I have a sickness of A, B, and C. Maybe they're not telling you everything because their doctor didn't tell them everything. So says Rav Moshe Feinstein, in that situation, what do you do? First come, first serve. You have no way of knowing who's more dangerously ill. First come, first serve, because no life is more important than the other. So to sum up the two points of view we've seen until now, comes a Chazon Ish and says, either you give an equal amount, or you do eeny, meeny, miny, mo, because there's no way of saying one life is more important than the other. Comes Rav Moshe Feinstein and says, in a perfect world where you know who's more dangerously ill, you treat them first. But if you don't know, which is usually what happens, like when you try to vaccinate the entire population, first come, first serve. The governor of Alberta decided that's what we're going to do in Alberta. Long lines, no triage. That's Rav Moshe Feinstein's point of view. Forget about who is more susceptible. Forget about who would probably get more sick from H1N1. Forget about who may die from it and who may just get sick from it. Rav Moshe Feinstein says it's very hard to determine. First come, first serve in an emergency room, and I'm going to apply it to the situation of vaccines as well. First come, first serve, no life is more important than the other. Yes, babe.
But he doesn't say first come, first serve if there are other circumstances, he said, where you don't know.
Correct.
But if you do know that there are risks, a much higher risk to a particular population.
Absolutely. As I said, if you're able to determine who's more dangerously ill, he would say vaccinate them first. But if you can't determine, and he said it was very difficult to determine, then first come, first serve. So again, Faye is absolutely correct. If you can able to determine who is more susceptible to H1N1, then the dangerously ill people go beforehand. But if you can't, first come, first serve.
But according to the example that the folks I gave, there was one person that appeared sicker, but the treatment's likely not going to help them survive.
Right.
And the other person who was maybe at that moment wasn't quite as sick,
right,
but could deteriorate and treatments would help that person.
Right.
So are you saying that Rabbi Feinstein's argument would be to treat the first person even who was sicker, even though it would be less likely to survive, and that the second person would likely...
He says in this particular responsa, which is a long one, I really abbreviated it, that because in Jewish law no life is more important than the other, and we do see significance in even prolonging a life for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and we can even violate Shabbos for what we call chayei sha'ah, which means you might live for another hour, then yes, even though they're more dangerously ill, but any treatment won't save them totally, he would say to treat them first. At this moment, they're more dangerously ill. And that's the perspective of Jewish law, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, modern medical ethics might not agree with that, because if you have limited resources, why give all the morphine to someone that's about to die? And I can understand that logic, too. But according to normative Jewish law, we say that even living for another hour is important, because during that hour, you can accomplish a lot. What can a sick person do during the last hour of his life? Repent, forgive, do another mitzvah. There's yet what to do in that small period of time. So yes, that goes counter to much of our, I would say, modern or postmodern thinking when you have limited resources. But yes, he does say that, Dr. Allen, which is interesting.
Continuing that, all right? So if you start to deal with the second person, and then the first person deteriorated to the point where they were sicker than the first person, would it then be okay to go stop treating the first person and start treating the second person?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's like a ping pong.
You can't do that. Once you're into treating the first person, how do you sort of break off?
Well, that's the point.
No. Once you started treating the first person, as we already saw, and he has the respirator, you don't take him off the respirator to give it to the second person. Because as we saw, he has the resource in his hands, his life goes first. However, if you're treating, meaning you're the doctors, and you're giving treatment, and then all of a sudden the second person deteriorates, and the first person's stable, you do go and go to the second person. And it's like a ping pong here. But that's why Rav Moshe Feinstein says it's impossible. What are you going to do? You're going to keep on looking at the EKG of the first person as you're treating the second person? It's very difficult. So therefore, he says, in the commonplace of an emergency room, it's first come, first serve. Whoever comes in first gets treated at that moment. Now, what we do today, I think, in Canada, is you try to determine who's more dangerously ill and who's not. Who needs to be treated first and who needs to be treated second. So a guy comes in holding his chest and the second person comes in with a cut. It's pretty easy.
But those are obvious, but
right.
You have two people coming
the chest. Holding the chest and one is indigestion and all they need is seltzer and the other person needs oxygen. It's very hard. You're right. Okay. Let's go on to the third opinion, and that's of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Again, big decider of Jewish law of the 20th century. Ultimately, died in 1994. I have never seen a bigger funeral in Israel in my life. He was accepted by every segment of the population. Even if he wasn't a genius, he was the sweetest man that I personally ever knew. Just a sweet, kind, nice, soft-spoken man. And his influence was endless. And like, you would look at him and you'd say, I am neder. Because he would talk so nice, and he was sweet, and he'd grab your hand and go like this, and an amazing mind. And he lived in a little house in Shari Chesed neighborhood in Jerusalem, and he lived with his mother-in-law his whole life, and he said, it's my mother-in-law's house, she sits at the head of the table on Shabbos. I was talking about a major rabbi in Israel. Her house, Shabbos, I sit over here, she's at the head of the table. So, as my Rosh Yeshiva Rav Lichtenstein once said, even if he wasn't a genius, he'd be the sweetest man in Yerushalayim. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in the top of the next page, quotes the Pri Megadim, which is an interpretation on the code of Jewish law, that says that in a case in which you have an acutely dangerous ill patient and a doubtful dangerously ill patient, who do you treat first? The dangerously ill patient that you know for sure. right? A sure situation with a doubtful situation. You treat the sure situation. So if you know this guy's having a heart attack, and another person comes in, he may be having a heart attack, but may be having indigestion, you don't know. But the first person you know is having a heart attack, they are already in the ambulance, did an AKG, looked at his blood work and said, this guy is having a heart attack, you treat him first. Fine. If you could determine that, that's what the Prima Gadim says. However, he says, in a normative situation, it's hard to determine that. And therefore, he says, you have to take into consideration, A, the extent of danger, B, the probability to cure, namely, are you able to cure this person, C, the Gemara and Horayot that we saw, Kohen before a Levi, perhaps a woman before a man before a woman, Kohen before a Levi, free person before a slave. All those things come into consideration. And he's writing this response, and at the end he says, I'll tell you honestly that I'm not making a firm determination since the questions are very profound and I have no clear proof. And it's hard in that response to get a clear-cut answer to our question, but he seems to end by saying that what do? You go by the triage in the Gemara in Horayot. The triage of redeeming from captives is the triage for H1N1, is the triage for emergency rooms. That's the triage you follow. Limited resources, either doctors on staff and nurses, respirators, medicine, whatever it might be. You look in the Gemara. Every doctor, I guess, has to know that Gemara by heart, and as we saw, it was pretty long. And that's it. You go by that Gemara. Child, adults, slaves, etc., etc. That's what it seems to be his determination. But again, he does say it's hard for me to make a firm determination since these questions are very profound. So to sum up his point of view, if you know for sure this person's in danger and this person's in doubtful danger, you treat the person in true danger. If you don't know for sure, he seems to say, follow the Gemara and Horayot. Exactly, that triage in the Gemara. But then he does say that it seems like in the modern world that would be impossible to follow. A woman before a man, it would be impossible in any hospital in the world to follow it, and he was living in Israel where it's a so-called Jewish country. Okay? So to sum up the three points of view we saw until now, the Chazon Ish comes and says, listen, either you treat them equally, or no life is more important. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, if you can determine who's more dangerous for you, great, but if you can't, first come, first serve. Comes along Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and says, if you can determine who's more dangerously ill, great, but if you can't, follow the Gemara and Horayot, woman before man, etc. Very hard to implement in a hospital. The fourth and last point of view for this morning is the Tzitz Eliezer. Who is the Tzitz Eliezer? Once again, his mother didn't say, Tzitz Eliezer, come home, wash your hands, it's time to eat dinner, time to take a bath and brush your teeth. Tzitz Eliezer, maybe she talked in Yiddish, so it's up to your Latin. I don't think so. What was his name?
Eliezer.
Anyone. His name was Eliezer. We're doing good. Last name, Waldenberg. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg was a big decider of Jewish law, lived in Jerusalem, again, non-denominational in the Orthodox world. He didn't necessarily say, I'm a religious Zionist or I'm an ultra-Orthodox. He was absolutely in the middle, accepted by all. His claim to fame was he was the posek, decider of Jewish law for a very important hospital in Israel called Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem. Until his death, basically. He died 2 years ago? 3 years ago? He lived a very long life. He was a prolific writer. I believe he has 20 volumes of his response. I forgot by, okay? Here I'm quoting from the ninth volume, just to tell you the ninth is somewhere in the middle. Okay? The Tzitz Eliezer could take up a bookshelf. Rav Eliezer Waldenberg was involved in hospitals his whole life. He was the posek for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. So he was not just from the outside commenting. Doctors came to consult with him. Shaarei Tzedek is a religious hospital. Religious doctors came into his house day in and day out. He was in there. He knew what was happening. So I take his point of view very seriously because the Tzitz Eliezer was in hospital. What does the Tzitz Eliezer say? He quotes a response of the Radbaz. The Radbaz lived around the time of Rav Yosef Karo, around the 16th century, who says that a person is not obligated to endanger themselves in order to save another person. So, for example, if a person has AIDS, then when it comes to, God forbid, his death, then what do we tell the Chevra Kadisha? Wear gloves during his recht, his tahara. Why? Because a person is not obligated to endanger themselves in order to save someone else or do a tahara on a dead body, obviously.
That's becoming normal.
Absolutely. Yeah. Today's the norm to wear gloves, but obviously it's very, very important in a case where you might endanger yourself. And therefore, he says, the doctors state that if two people come, one is in a potential life-endangering situation, and the other is clearly in a life-endangering situation and needs the same medicine, and you debate who to give it to. Again, one person might be, one person might not be. According to the Radbaz, he doesn't give up the medicine he already has, and it's forbidden to do so. Again, if you have the medicine in your hand, you don't give it up to someone else. And then he quotes the Prima Gadim that we just saw, that if a dangerously ill person comes in and a doubtful ill person comes in, you treat the doubtful one. And he comes to the following conclusion on our question. He comes and says that according to the Gemara and Bava Metzia, we follow the opinion of Ben Petura, that you give it equally to everyone, because no life is more important than the other. And then he adds, based on what I would say his medical profession being in a hospital, that why do you do that? The Gemara said, if you have the vaccine in your hand, you give it to yourself. But if I have the vaccine, third party, he says, we don't follow Rabbi Akiva's opinion of eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Like the Chazon Ish says, what do? We give it equally. Why do we give it equally? There is a chance that maybe more medicine will come in tomorrow. Very good. Sherman says, you never know. You're in the desert. You're walking. You're thirsty. There's a pitcher of water. It's not enough for two people. You give it equally to both. Perhaps out of nowhere a helicopter will land. Perhaps out of nowhere you had the wrong map and you're just 20 minutes away from civilization. He quotes the Natsiv from Volozhin, very great decider of Jewish law at the latter part of the 19th century, that says that's what we do when a third party has the resource. You give it equally with the hopes that perhaps as time goes on, more resources will come in. And Rav Waldenberg is, I'm saying, he's living in the hospital. He says, listen, right now you don't have enough respirators, but maybe give the respirator equally to both. And meanwhile, doctors, nurses, administrators will make phone calls and get another respirator in. You have vaccine just for part of the population. Give it equally to all, and maybe tomorrow, Thursday, Friday, you'll get more vaccines. Is he totally off his rocker? What happened in Canada? How did we begin the class? We were all going nuts with triage of H1N1. As of January 2010, we have an excess of vaccines.
I suppose of extra, too.
I think they always knew there was going to be an excess.
Mm-hmm.
It was an issue of what was available as it was coming through.
That's right.
So part of the reason for the excess is not everybody got vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because we chose not to get it.
That's
also
true.
Also, they bought enough vaccine for two doses for everyone.
Ah. Right. So to sum up, ladies and gentlemen, what we said this morning, we have an obligation to save lives in a normative situation, an obligation to heal, and not to mention the fact that not one life is more important than the other. However, we're living in a real world where there's not enough resources for everyone, and therefore, if you have the resource in your hand, you save your own life, and all agree. If a third party has the resource, we did see a Gemara that started giving us triage options, woman before a man, slave before this, but outside of one decider of Jewish law, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, no one seemed to say to follow that Gemara when it comes to our question. He did say it, but he himself said, A, I'm not making a determination, and B, it's very hard to follow it. The four opinions we saw with regard to triage allocation is as follows. Triage vaccination allocation, or triage in vaccination. The Chazon Ish says, you have no way of knowing and saying you're more important than me, therefore give it equally to all. Okay? Or he says, no, you have no way of knowing, pick one. Because you're not going to be able to heal if you give equally to all, pick one. On the other extreme came along Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, we just saw and said, give it equally to all. Why? You never know, maybe more resources will come. So two opinions. Number one, pick one. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Number two, equal. Perhaps more resources will come later. Right now, equal. No more life is more important than the other. In between these two points of view, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach seemed to say, follow the Gemara in Horayot, slave before free person, whatnot, but he says it's very hard to do. But the Rav Moshe Feinstein said, first come, first serve, because you never know properly, or you can't sign in the dotted line, who's more dangerous than the other. Now, there's obviously variables of what I just said, like if you know for sure you're more dangerously ill than you, both Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, as well as Rav Waldenberg, as well as Rav Moshe Feinstein said, you treat the dangerously ill person. But we're talking about where it's hard to determine that. So the four points of view we saw this morning is A, pick one. B, equal. C, the Gemara and Horayot. And D, first come, first serve. Those are the four points of view in the modern deciders of Jewish law with regard to our question. First of all, it's my hope and prayer that we won't have to ever deal with this again. In the case we do, it is not an easy question to deal with, and therefore Rabbi Ellis, I would say in a very bright way, called this a medical ethics workshop, and not what I would call a medical halakha class, because we're not giving a answer that will answer all variables. There's many variables to what I just said. Dangerously ill, doubtful dangerously ill, resource, whatnot. But we try to give four points of view as to what to do when you have limited resources. Either you give everyone equally to the entire population, or you just pick. Or first come, first serve. Or you say, who do we need more socially, economically, for the population? Israeli citizens. That, I think, is an outrage because of all the opinions we just saw. Yes, Israel can come and say we have to take care of our population first, but it's also a Jewish country. What do you mean? When someone comes to a hospital, you right away ask for insurance, or you go ahead and you treat the patient and you're worried about the insurance later?
If they don't come out on an ambulance,
you ask for insurance.
But this case is particularly bad because these are students doing a pro. It's a student coming into the program for a year there. I mean, it'd be different if it was
I think it's an outrage.
Coming for a week.
No, the third party means you have two people, and you're the third party, you have the vaccine in your hand. You're the doctor. You have the respirator.
I'm the first party.
What? You're the patient,
party.
And you're the first party, yes.
Two patients. The doctor's the third party.
Yes.
Two patients.
Yes. So ladies and gentlemen, medical ethics by definition is not something that you can give a clear-cut answer to anything. And I would say that when you're saving lives, there's no such thing as a perfect answer, because by definition, when you save lives, you have to make triage decisions. But you want to hear a common example of what I just said. Let's look at the Kastner train. Have everyone heard the story of the Kastner train? 1944. Kastner decides he pays off the Nazis, he's going to save people from Hungary. He puts on the train his family members. He puts on the train the Satma Rebbe for reasons beyond my comprehension. And he puts on the train others, and they're saved, and the rest of the community are killed by the Nazis. And this man was assassinated in Israel. This man, it was a Kastner trial. It was a terrible thing because what did he do? He said, your life is more important than your life. As years went by, I started to stop blaming Kastner for a very simple reason. When you save lives, there's no right and wrong. All you can do is do your best. Do your best. As you could see here, the deciders of Jewish law can't come to a clear-cut conclusion. There's variables on every side. You have to do your best. Canada, as you saw on the second page, came to a certain list, and they did their best. And when you save lives, by definition, people will be saved, people will not be saved, and that's the way it is when you save lives. It is much easier to deal with meat and milk mixing in the kitchen. Yes. There's a right and a wrong. It's much easier to deal with, Rabbi, can I put on my lights on Shabbos? There's a right and a wrong. But when it comes to saving lives, by definition, someone's going to be hurt, someone's not. You can't save everyone. We don't have enough doctors and enough nurses and enough resources to save the whole world. We do our best, and as you could see from that source, I said you have the right to heal, because by definition, when you save lives, you won't be able to heal anyone. So it's my hope and prayer that we will continue to be ethical and moral and do our best to save lives and to heal people, but know that sometimes we won't be able to have a clear-cut answer to say it all. And I'll just add that we sometimes in life think we do have all the answers. Part of life is sometimes saying, I don't have a clear-cut solution for everything. Look at Israel today. How many years has Israel tried to make peace? How many? And every time they suggest something and the opposition party says it's a terrible idea, they ask the opposition, so what's your alternative? Well, sometimes there is no alternative. There is no answer to answer the vital, crucial, profound problems of Israeli politics living in a sea of Arabs. You don't have a clear-cut conclusion. Perhaps you can have certain ways to deal with it. Economically, maybe you can have a peace which is not a warm peace, but a cold peace. There are ways to deal with it, but you don't have a solution. And that's what I think is part of life, especially in the question of limited medical resources for the whole population. Thank you for listening. When we get prophecy again. I hope that comes soon.
When we have these crucial decisions.